Everything starts at the human. And oftentimes, we look at a founder as a founder first instead of a human first.
Derek, spending an entire day with you, you driving us around in your Prius, my mother-in-law cussing me out because she's like, where are y'all? You have your kid here.
Hi, my name is Dominic Artis, founder of the Act House. And I'm so excited to be partnering with Florida A&M University on this initiative to bring three students from three different disciplines, business, graphic design, and computer science, to create their first startup in 1 year in one house.
You had a solo founder with a great idea, but it couldn't pick up enough team members along the way. And if you think about it, if I can actually bring on certain team members that have a particular skill set, then that reduces my need of money in some form of capacity, because now they can pick up that work.
Tell me what that means for you to have invested in 35 companies up until this point.
To be honest with you, I've...
In this episode, I'm joined by Dominic Artis, founder of Act House and managing partner of Act Ventures. We're getting ready to talk about how he's gone from traveling the world as a military brat to management consulting, politics, to now investing in some of the amazing companies that are going to reshape the world. What it means to invest in 35 companies and growing. His personal thoughts around creativity, productivity, having a uniform in life, and then also literally, and then more than anything, what it means to have an audacious moment from moving to the middle of the United States and drastically changing the world through investment, passion, support, and dollars. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Felicia.
Tell me a little bit about who Dominic Artis was before like Act House.
Oh, man. That's an interesting story. I'll truncate it a little bit, but one, excited to be on the podcast. This is the first season. It was amazing. And one, happy that we can actually sit down and chat longer here, so it should be fun. But born in Texas, youngest of four, moved around from Indiana to Maryland, spent the longest place before I turned eight in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. That was in Desert Storm. And so we were over there for 4 years, which is pretty exciting. And then when we moved back, probably about 94, 95, landed in Tallahassee, Florida. And, you know, it was cool coming back to the States. I will say there was this duality, right? Like in the military and at that time, you were well taken care of. So didn't want for nothing, didn't know nothing, didn't know what lack was until I came back to the States. And you know, you start to ask certain questions and your parents start having certain answers and you're like, okay, like what is going on here? So what ended up happening was my entrepreneurial gene just started to turn on. So we lived in this apartment complex and kind of imagine like, I don't know, like little rascals for the most part, but we were a little bit growner, you know, just running around having fun. But then I realized, okay, we always go to this K-76 and we buy snacks. Like what could I sell to the squad and everybody, all the kids in the community, in order to make some money. And that was it. Like my thought process at the time, or what I realized, I didn't know was economics, but trickle down economics just didn't work like that in my house. Like nothing was coming down. And so just had to go out and get it and have some fun. So, yeah, I was always curious, always inquisitive, always loved helping people and, knew what value was at a young age, but didn't know what the word value was at a young age. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Where did the curiosity come from? Because I see it a lot in the work that you do now.
Yeah. I think, you know, being a military brat really helped out a lot. Mm-hmm. Like there was always a level of instability, mm-hmm. like as you're moving from place to place to place. And so if you want to actually have friends, you have to ask questions. Yeah. If you want to get connected to your surrounding environment because you don't know how long you're going to be there, mm-hmm. you just have to continue to ask those questions. So I think like that movement, that instability forced me in positions to ask questions like about people, about my surroundings, and learn fast. Mm-hmm. And then also experience like the heartbreak because you had to leave. Okay. So I think that's where the seed started. Yeah.
What age did you guys move to Tallahassee?
I was turning eight. Mm-hmm. Literally, we landed 2 days later. We're at Chuck E. Cheese having a birthday party joint with one of my cousins by the name of Jabari. It was crazy. It was a good time. But I was still like sad.
Cause did you say you were drunk at Chuck E. Cheese?
No. No, not at all. Maybe off the Sprite and the Coca-Cola. But No, I was. We had a joint birthday party.
Joint. Yeah, okay, joint, my bad.
A joint
bad.
Birthday party.
It's the Florida. It's the Florida.
It's cool. But definitely not drunk at 7 or 8 years old.
I was like, where is this going? Okay, man, so.
Yeah, that would be a life, bro. Talk about a start.
So Tallahassee.
Yep.
FAMU.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about what was your HBCU experience like?
Man, it was transformative. You know, I think when you're growing up in like a very diverse global environment, you necessarily, even though how much, you know, your parents, they educate you and they tell you about your history and all that good stuff, but you never really understand like your culture and your people at a certain level until you're around it and you experience it. And so I think for me, FAMU represented a place where I saw pretty much African Americans on all levels of socioeconomics, right? All levels of class, various cultures, subcultures within like black communities, which is amazing. And had some amazing professors there that really left just an indelible like thumbprint on me. And like Will Guzman and Marissa Lewis, people that I still look up to this day, but fed me so many gems that were amazing. And I think FAMU is like, you know, I heard you had my guy from Corey from Support Black Colleges on. He was talking about how Howard's the number one HBCU. And I don't want to get into those debates. You know, like it's the numbers are the numbers. So we let those speak for themselves. But the reality is you like our band, the culture, like friends, like long-term friends that I still move with today. We're just connected. And I think FAMU also opened me up to a world of like service and public service, which was real cool. And so I love my FAMU experience was awesome. It was amazing. Mm-hmm.
How did you then get into local politics?
Man. So at FAMU, you do like the top things. So like if you go to like any other institution, I think, you know, if you play sports, you're going to do well. SGA doesn't really matter, like big predominantly like PWIs. At HBCUs, particularly FAM, if you were in the band, you were doing something with your life. Mm-hmm. If you were in student government, you were doing something with your life. If you were playing sports, you were like, oh, okay, like that's cool. And I ended up, so I went to FAMU for baseball. Was playing baseball my freshman year, redshirted, sophomore year, kind of 2 car accidents in fall practice. And I was an RA at the time. And I ended up just started hanging out with certain people. And they started moving me into the world of like Student Government Association. And so I became junior class vice president, vice chair of the campus activities board, ran for student body vice president. That was there's still articles about that election to this day. I'm not going to speak.
Is there a scandal?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I don't know, but it's in the past, you know, so it's there. You could Google it. Uh-huh. It'll probably be present. But while I was there, you just start developing like a true thirst for service. And you start seeing certain dots and layers of why things are the way they are in your community. And for myself, I was always very, hey, diagnose the problem. Let's get a sense and understanding of that. What solutions could help and then what type of, you know, barriers we have to move through in that regard. But I was in D.C., I was at a conference, and I met our local city commissioner at the time, Andrew Gillum. Mm-hmm. And it was a group of Rattlers we all met. I've never met him in Tallahassee. And I was invited to intern in his office. And from there, it was the deep submersion into local politics, getting a sense of everything from campaigns, writing policy, speeches, doing the other work that everybody has mentioned, like grabbing the coffee to dry clean and dry, picking up the car, like everything. But it was a transformative experience that I think let me understand the world in a very grand way, or in a local way, but had a very like broad perspective in how I approached it. So, yeah.
And so you left Tallahassee politics and went to management consulting.
So before that, I went from FAMU directly to Florida State in grad school. I thought my life was moving in the direction of public service, which it was. So I decided to do public administration. First semester, I was like, this is bull crap. I'm not about to be doing this. And so we're just learning bureaucracy. And so I ended up transitioning to the Urban Regional Planning and International Affairs joint master's program. And it was just problem solving. We're looking at issues, developing solutions. How do we deploy this in a micro way? And I spent 2.5 years at Florida State. And then after that, started my first company. So I had some university research that was all around citizen engagement technology. And one thing that I realized is that most local politicians, most politicians in itself, make decisions without actually checking the pulse of the people. Mm-hmm. And so I was very interested in how could we accelerate that understanding. Yeah. So therefore, policymakers could truly have information. So I, instead of taking this master thesis that I was presenting at different conferences around around the nation, and my topic was the urban planning of technology, I decided to start my first company. And in 2012, I graduated in December 2012. I turned down two or three jobs. My mom's looking at me like,
"What you doing with your life?"
And also, where you gonna stay, yeah. Right? And so I'm like, "Can I?" Ask pops and moms, "Hey, can I stay here?" I ended up then teaching at FAM. So I was an adjunct teacher. And if you know about adjunct teaching, you get paid per credit hour. Mm-hmm. And it is dismal.
Right.
Like, it's, and you're only getting paid. I'm only teaching one credit. Mm-hmm. So I'm only getting $1,000 for like 4 months. And I just started my entrepreneur journey, like the struggle, right? And then you get into it and you make it happen. So, yeah. Yeah.
You used to walk on FAMU's campus teaching with a briefcase and.
No, it's funny. So, like, you know, I had to suit up and all that good stuff, which was.
Did you have to?
No, I did. I did because I was 26 uh-huh. teaching. And the last thing you're going to find me is some scandal with some student. Like, that just wasn't going to happen. So I just needed, I need to look older.
Okay.
Right. So anything that made me look older, I was down for.
Okay.
And so it was cool. Yeah. Made it out alive.
So how did work in like management consulting kind of frame what you do now? Like the process, the systems,
yeah.
The
I think going into leaving out, like we failed that startup 2014. And I remember I went into the mayor's office, closed out his term, and Jay Townsend recruited me to come to Booz Allen. And you know, there was one thing when you have like an ability to think creatively, an ability to ideate, like you have the talent. But going into management consulting, particularly in the retail space, private sector, provided me the chops, right? How to organize, how to frame, understanding systems, how to really think and put things together. And I think, you know, in the first startup, there were certain things that we did from a systems perspective, which was fun. However, one thing that was very interesting is that in the big box retail, there's a level of systemization and like optimization that they run on, which is aggressively impressive. And I just started to like take snapshots. Like I started to look at what were the underlying principles of how they do what they do and then just put it in my own way, where I started to now, okay, let me develop this framework and that framework. And so while I was there, ideas would come. And honestly, it was like therapy, right? Like I needed a rehab. Like I just failed my startup. Just ended a long relationship at the time. Finances were shot. And so I was happy to be making some guap. Mm-hmm. Like I wanted some money. And the experiences were great. And all of that, I think that those 2 years of like hyper-focused work, of really kind of touching strategy, product dev, cybersecurity, put me in a position to just think, to have the confidence again, to have I have the chops, I have the skill sets, and I can create something new. And that's when I started thinking about the Act House. Mm.
And so you moved back to Tallahassee from there?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, moved back to Tallahassee. I ended up, so what happened was I had the idea for the Act House. And I talked to my mentor, and he's just like, "Don, that's a damn good idea." And I was like, "Yeah." He was like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." So started developing the pitch decks, you know, whole nine yards. Pitched it to my alma mater, and we said we'll do it. So we're supposed to cut ribbon 2016, but we ended up cutting ribbon 2017. So between 2016, 2017, that year, I ended up being director of incubation programs and operations at Domi Station. And it was literally taking everything that I was doing, you know, with more of our Fortune 500 companies, Fortune 100 companies, and bringing it now to the startup space, bringing it to companies that are like going from like zero to one to those companies that are already making north of $1 million in revenue. And I loved it. Reengineered the programs. Me and Lucas Lindsay like ran that shop. It was awesome. And he gave me purview to just really like re-engineer the programs. And rightfully so. Like we, before we came, They saw 53 companies in a 9-week startup program, and they had multiple cohorts. Only one was still existing. Mm. And we were just like, nah, we're not, like, that's not going to be our legacy. Yeah. So we re-engineered the programs. We saw about 26 companies, 24 actually, 24 companies. Six went on to raise their seed rounds. And we did all of that within like a year and 8 months. Mm-hmm. And it was awesome. It was exciting. And it was, but that was all happened back in Tallahassee, Florida, my home city. Yeah.
So the organization was supporting 53 companies, you said?
Yeah. So Domi Station was an incubation, kind of like a co-working space and a community incubator. Mm-hmm. But the program, the incubator that they had about 53 companies that came through. But it just, people were just trying to figure out, like, how do you really run an incubator? Yeah. And so, like, to their credit, they jumped out there and made it happen. They pioneered it, like, in Tallahassee. But we just kind of came and built on top of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so when we're thinking about people, organizations that build programs, right, especially in support of entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, there was, like, a large number of companies that closed or just did not work.
Yeah.
What's the factor in within that?
That's a great question. I had many nights reflecting on this, and I think it really kind of bolstered a lot of my thoughts in ACT, House, ACT as a model, team model. And when you boil it down, everything starts at the human. And oftentimes we look at a founder as a founder first instead of a human first. And humans have, like, brilliance, talents, skills. And so if you start to look at, we did this diagnosis on those companies and even the ones that didn't make it in our cohorts, the common denominator was team. Mm-hmm. You had a solo founder with a great idea, but it couldn't pick up enough team members along the way. And if you think about it, if I can actually bring on certain team members that have a particular skill set, then that reduces my need of money in some form or capacity, because now they can pick up that work. Mm-hmm. Because if I'm a solo founder, I'm only trying to raise the money in order to either outsource for a particular skill set that needs to be moved on. Mm-hmm. And so as we started to diagnose this, and I actually started to reflect, I wrote a post-mortem report of my first startup. And I wrote down three things. One was, hey, Dom, like, this leadership visionary thing, you got this down. Like, there's something here. Two, when it comes to being a facilitator of human potential and taking ideas and moving them across, you can do that. The third one was team, like architects, creatives, and techies. And so having that reflection and then having the experience of, okay, hey, incubators and accelerators, if we actually focus more on team, we could actually get people across the hump. And that's what started the ACT House.
Mm. Are you building a high growth business in tech, healthcare, AI, media entertainment, or consumer goods and services? If so, we'd like to help you scale. Apply for a chance to win capital, coaching, and access to an amazing community of diverse innovators. Applications for the 4th annual Black Ambition Prize competition are now open. Don't miss your chance to win $1 million. Apply today at blackambitionprize.com.
How do you get to a point where you can have clarity around exactly why you fail and the role that you played in it, right? Because I think a lot of entrepreneurs don't do that, to do that. They're scared to do that and take some sort of ownership to the point where you write it down. Like, these are the three reasons why I know it failed and I played a role in that in some capacity.
In the famous words of Denzel Washington, like, I'm leaving here with something, right? Like, we lost, we failed, right? And when you think about all the energy that you put into it, and sometimes the expectations that you place on yourself, the things that you've told friends, like, we're going to be a $1 million company, like, we're going to be a big hit. You know, it's tough to have the weight of those quote-unquote statements and promises you put out there, like, on yourself. And so what happens is that there's this reverse kind of element of pride, where it's not that, like, you're haughty and boastful, like, prideful in that way. You're just shamed, right? You feel the shame of it. And so for me, I was like, well, I felt that shame, and writing was a way to process it, right? And so I don't think I went and said, hey, let me write a post-mortem report like for what I've done. I didn't know that's what I actually did. I knew I needed to process the experience of the failed startup. And I think the piece that I've always come to learn is that, look, if you can have enough humility, and my definition of it is being willing to admit, being confident and willing to admit what you don't know and what you know. And having that perspective for me has been transformative, and just always being willing to exploit my own ignorance. And so I think when most founders, just professionals, like even our own professional experiences, we move from, if it's interesting, I'll say this. Oftentimes we may judge somebody in society or culture that goes from like relationship to relationship to relationship. It doesn't take any time in between, just like, oh, I got this, you know, girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And then now you got another one, bro. And then like another one. And so
the Lori Harvey effect.
Exactly, right?
Being messy. No, I'm sorry.
So what happens is
that. Let me stop. That was awful.
No, you good. So what happens is that you end up, we end up kind of looking at that person like, all right, what's going on? Mm-hmm. But we do it with our jobs.
Yeah.
Right? And so I've always been, okay, hey, we have to take this time to do the reflection because we have to capture the lessons.
Right.
Like we only have our experiences and we can only look back and develop language and those things. So it's important for founders, I mean, and important for professionals too. Mm.
All right, so I want to get into where you are now with Act House, but like from a lifestyle standpoint as an entrepreneur, I think you do some really interesting things that I just want you to dive
a
little bit deeper, right? And so
most people call them weird, but.
No, it's not weird. I mean, I think it's oftentimes you meet people, you know people.
Yeah.
I think we met on a Facebook post.
Yep.
About like some of your Act House students coming to Black Tech Week years ago. That turned into me and Derek spending an entire day with you.
Entire day.
You driving us around in your Prius.
Yep.
Like exploring.
I still had that Prius too.
It was a time. It was a time.
Yeah.
And my mother-in-law cussed me out because she's like, where are y'all? You have your kid here. And we're like, this really cool guy is driving us around like Tallahassee and showing us like the vision of what he's building and what's possible.
Yeah.
Right? Now I don't remember where I was going
with
that.
You're talking about habits and stuff like that, I guess.
So there's some things that I've seen you do that I think are really helpful because some people can call that weird, but there's other things about us just other than our work, right?
Yeah.
Or there's things that you do to allow you to shine in your work or make it easy or much more productive. And so, you know, you have a uniform.
I do.
Why?
It's three reasons. One, black kid growing up in the South, working in politics, you know, suits, ties, all that stuff. And I think it was one time I got tired of looking like someone in the space. Like, so I went to an interview. This one guy had on the same tie that I had. I was like, dang, he went to Macy's, right? And so at that time, I started to differentiate some things. But I recognized one thing that I almost had to dress in a certain way for someone to then receive the insight, wisdom, knowledge, and experiences I was sharing. So that was one. Two, there was an element of I've been in that world where my mind was so draped in that that I didn't want to think about it anymore. And I was like, okay, like, just accept me for who I am, right? And so I think that was the second one. And the third one, people, if you notice something, people will tell you look good. And that one thing that you're like, I need to retire this, and you put it on, and then you go out, and they're like, girl, you look good, right? And you're like, this old thing? And so what I realized, I said, okay, there's a couple of things that I wear that people give me compliments on. Just be consistent. Mm-hmm. Like, if I need my dopamine hits, let's just go ahead and run this up, right? Yes. So in essence, a black T-shirt, some blue jeans, and I can switch up the shoes, generally people say, you look good. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that, and I was like, okay, there's no need for me to shift this. So 7 years, I've just been in a uniform, And I'm actually working on a new one now, which is going to be pretty interesting. But
so you do it for the compliments and not the.
I do it for the ease of thought. I wake up in the morning, but the compliments are good. I need them. Yeah. You know.
I think there was an Entrepreneur Inc. magazine article years ago that talked about how like Mark Zuckerberg was just like, I have to make a lot of really big decisions single day.
That's it.
And I don't want that to be one of them. I want to simplify.
Yeah.
So he wears the exact same thing.
Yeah, it's helpful. I mean, it's in the morning time. If you think about how much we put into what we wear, sometimes it would be a 45-minute endeavor. And now, even if I'm late for a meeting, I tank top, T-shirt, boom. And it's like 25 hanging up in my closet. Mm-hmm. One of my friends said I look like Doug Funny because he had like the same uniform in his closet all the time. But it alleviates a lot of stress so I can focus on more creative and big picture things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
And so you do a train ride every year.
Yeah.
Three-day train ride. You go to Middlebury every year.
Every summer
to study.
A new language. Yeah.
The uniform. Mm-hmm. And then you write these really interesting letters on Instagram with a typewriter.
Yeah.
That are not like the investor thesis and like how am I going to solve all world problems. They're really kind of reflective and introspective. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Yeah, I started, I want to say about a year and a half ago. Well, the beginning of 2022 and 2021, I had captured that typewriter and I wanted it. I was at an estate sale. This lady had it. And I was like, dang. And I was riding my motorcycles with a friend. I was driving off. I pulled over on the side of the road to get my GPS right. And she stopped by. She said, young man, do you want this typewriter? I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, it's all yours. And I had to call a friend to pick it up because I can't put it on a motorcycle. But nonetheless, I told myself in that moment, I'm not going to squander this gift. Mm-hmm. And I've always written poetry when I was younger. And writing is a talent, but there's many different types of skills that I have in writing. And so I told myself, okay, if I do a good job in strategic planning of my annual, my quarter, my week, like in my day, and finding the connective alignment there, then how can I put more intentionality and speak towards my day and my months? So I was doing it in the day, but I was like, okay, how can I set the intention for the month? So I just started writing these letters to the month. And it's a transformative process for myself personally. But I think also it demystifies in a way that oftentimes people will associate you with your role. Mm-hmm. And they will associate with all the history that comes with that role, not with you.
Yeah.
And it gives a way for people to understand that, like, hey, I'm human. Mm-hmm. I breathe like you breathe. I have some of the same challenges that you have.
Your work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm just processing them in a way that's a little bit more public. Mm-hmm. But I think the beautiful part is having so many people now write letters to the month. Mm-hmm. Is actually pretty cool.
Nice.
And seeing people kind of unpack their own process, speaking to their future, I think it's just something that's very powerful.
Mm-hmm. So with Act House and Act Ventures.
Act Ventures now,
Act Ventures,
yeah.
You moved from Tallahassee to Tulsa.
I did.
Which I think is a very ambitious move. And I think we had that conversation when you were thinking about it.
Yeah.
But you guys have invested in 35 companies up into that point.
Yeah.
And I think we're in this moment where people are just like 35, 100, $100 million fund, like just throwing out these really big numbers and not like, tell me what that means for you to have invested in 35 companies up into this point.
To be honest with you, I still don't understand the weight of it. Mm-hmm. To be honest, you know, when I started Act House, we started it in the way that we knew how to, which was, okay, hey, what talents and skills are available to us? How can we make impact? Let's do that now. And at that time, being able to have a fund where we can even make an investment was so far out of like reach or grasp. And I think some of that is you have to unpack your cultural beliefs of who you are. Some of that is you have to unearth some of the cultural gifts that you have and really stand firm in that and to elevate that. And to now be at a place where the team we've like invested, you know, into 35 companies. Those companies have gone off and raised like $12.5 million themselves. It's about $6 million of revenue on the books. And but to see the stories is just amazing.
Right.
And I was on that train ride for my birthday from L.A. to Seattle. And the team, all the founders wrote me letters. Mm. And just reading the letters was pretty amazing. But the coolest part of it was that the opportunity to invest actually opened up an opportunity to invest in who they were as a human, mm-hmm. which then was transformative in their life to then take their company to the next level.
Right.
Because the reality is this entity can be bankrupt tomorrow, but that person isn't bankrupt. Mm-hmm. And so if you invest in the human, you get an opportunity to actually see them take this vessel or another vessel to the next level. But it's great. And it's cool also, too, because we're kind of just getting started in some of it.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to see what like year three, year four, year five look like mm-hmm. as we continue on this. Okay. Yeah.
You have this saying, it's about getting 2% better every single day.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Why not 1% better every day? Why not 10%? Like, what is the significance around like 2% better every day?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. This saying emerged during the pandemic, and my friends and I, we call ourselves like thought partners of like 2% better. Carmichael, my guy Keenan, and we all went on this guy's trip to Boise, Idaho, like in the middle of the pandemic. Flights were like aggressively cheap. And toured out Wyoming and the whole nine yards. But it's really this notion to take what you already have mm-hmm. and give it your all, but add a little on top. And it's just about incremental growth. Mm-hmm. If you even think about like Wall Street traders, they are focused on earning 2% of their book, mm-hmm. their total like AUM. And if they can earn 2% for that day, then life is good. Well, if you take 2%, you compound that over the year, you know, we're north of 600, 700% in growth. And so for us, it's always this notion of like life is a limitless game, mm-hmm. right? There's a level of abundance in it, but I can't think that I can have it all at once. Mm-hmm. And if I just focus on getting 2% better, I'm not worried about judging myself from yesterday. And I'm not worried about, like, tomorrow. I'm staying present in today.
Yeah.
And if I can treat people better, 2% better, then that's good. If how I approached my work had more joy, better diligence, better intentionality, getting 2% better. And you just start to see the gains over time because there's so many times that we put goals in front of us mm-hmm. and we just keep staring at the goals. Like, man, it's so big. It's so big. It's like, nah, like, it's cool.
Yeah.
Just focus on today. Like, you don't know if you're going to wake up tomorrow, genuinely. Like, you just don't know. And so if you focus on today and just find the incremental growth, like, you will find yourself having more gratitude, more joy, mm-hmm. And more peace about life. And then ultimately people will see the fruit of that labor and say, man, you just keep growing, you know. And I think that's it changes you internally.
Nice. My last question for you.
Yeah.
What does success with everything that you're doing look like for you?
I just think about my ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
To hear their whisper and to hear them clap.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard a little whisper, but I haven't heard the clap yet.
Yeah.
So that means that there's a lot more to go. And I think genuinely, you know, your legacy is what people will write in some respects, but it is the fruit of your labor. And my hope is that when people eat from my plate in whatever capacity that looks like, they leave nourished, they leave full, they have the enzymes and the seeds to go create and do more. That's meaningful,
nice.
Like to me. The numbers will be there, and like that will be fantastic. But I think if I focus in that posture, that would be good. And ultimately, like when I one day do leave this earth, when the good man upstairs can say job well done, mm-hmm. I'm good.
Nice.
Like, that means that, all right, cool, we did it. Like, somebody else will come after me and talk about how we need to tear up the world and make it different mm-hmm. and get 2% better. And yeah, they say 3%. Who knows? So you have a finite time on Earth. So just enjoy it every day. So, yeah.
Nice. I love it. I heard Omi's mom in a conversation say to her, like, I can rest now. Like, that was, and I was like, ooh.
That's powerful.
That's powerful, right?
Yeah.
Like, someone, your parent or someone that came before you said, I can rest now.
Yeah.
Right? Or there's completion or job well done.
Yeah.
Or I'm going from 2% to 3%
yes.
to 10%
yeah.
to 100% better every single
yeah.
day. Dom, let the audience know where they can follow you online and continue
yeah.
to follow your journey.
Yeah. You can see us on the Act Out House. Well, not Act Out House. Act Out House is our website. At the Act House on IG, Twitter, I think LinkedIn as well. Personal IG, IamDArtis, IamDArdis, on IG. I'm never on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Barely.
It's
yeah,
now.
It's a lot. X, yeah, sorry. Sorry, Elon. But yeah, that's where you can find us.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dom,
you
for your time, your
you
wisdom.
Bet. Thank you.
And everyone give him a round of applause.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Heineken is proud to support Black Ambition in helping to unlock opportunities for its participating founders.